Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Tuesday, May 19th. It's been a month since the national headlines focused on a super typhoon that was to hit the Western Pacific. 17 people died and thousands suffered damage to their homes and businesses. But there's been little follow-up nationally. We have been reaching out to get information as residents of several islands still have limited access to power and water. What lessons can we learn here in Hawaii as we head into hurricane season? We turn our gaze to Molokai as we continue to look at climate solutions to long-standing problems. And we hear stories from the cockpit. A long-retired Hawaiian Airlines pilot looks back in a year of big changes for the airline. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The National Weather Service is to announce its forecast for our hurricane season later this week. Here at HPR, we've been looking across the Pacific as our neighbors have been dealing with the damage from Super Typhoon Sinlaku when it hit the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas last month. Federal agencies and the military have been assisting with recovery on Saipan, Tinian, Rota, Guam, and to some extent, the Federated States of Micronesia. We were able to connect with the Army Corps of Engineers yesterday afternoon. The unit is based here on Oahu, but members were dispatched out to Guam, anticipating the area to be hard hit by the Category 5 storm. Lieutenant Commander Adrian Biggerstaff saw the devastation firsthand. He expects it will take probably till midsummer before his team can return to Hawaii as it assists with the hardest hit area of Saipan.
We staged our team in Guam as the storm was coming through, not knowing where the storm would hit. And as we gained assurance that it was in CNMI and not Guam, we then pushed that team into Saipan and we immediately started pulling in generators days after the storm. At this point, we've installed 124 generators through this week, and we've completed almost 190 assessments of locations that need generators, and we're working through FEMA to determine the requirements to get those. But at this point, we've also begun removing some generators as the power plants here on Saipan have started to generate power and the distribution lines are distributing that power. We've been able to take off 41 generators that we've originally installed. So it's a really good news story. Overall, we've produced, if this means anything to your listeners, 3.3 gigawatt hours of power or of energy to the community out here. And our peak power that we've produced was 7.3 megawatts. So that is itself a small power plant of generation connected at one building at a time. So a lot of good work has been done in just getting temporary power to the communities. And to put that in a few different terms, that amount of power, that 3.3 gigawatt hours, that relates to about 3.3 million smartphone charges for the listener who regularly charges their smartphone. We have the temporary power mission, but we also are looking at assisting with grid power just to stay in the power vein, as we discussed. And we're working on Tinian to try to help get power to their grid faster than their power plant can generate it, allow their facility to start drying out and getting the repairs needed to their generation. But we're also trying to get temporary larger generators into the island. And we actually just got the first set yesterday, and we're getting the last large generator in today for the near term. And that'll be providing about 1.4 megawatts of sustained power to Tinian. And we have other generation capabilities coming up over the coming weeks to hopefully get them back to the original power. And while we do this, they're improving and expanding the grid with repairs to be able to have the load to receive that power and get the whole community back to their pre-storm state. So we're really proud of the efforts that the team have put in. Tremendous engineering and planning have gone into that effort.
I think the people here in Hawaii not experiencing a super typhoon with winds of this magnitude, you know, when the power goes out here for an hour or two, you know, people complain. But when they realize that, you know, you have islands that are without power for months, in some instances. It's more than just inconvenience, right? Like you say, getting the generators for the medical facilities, that kind of thing, critical infrastructure.
Absolutely. And the word critical is right. There are dialysis clinics that are dependent on their treatment schedules to have consistent power. And we being able to provide a generator there and connect it, it's something that's very meaningful to the patients, to the families, to the staff, and the doctors, physicians there on site. And one more thing to note is as you're bringing up power to the grid, reliability is sometimes in question those first days or weeks as you're adding more power, taking power off, having to adjust the lines to allow more power to eventually come on. So the stability takes time to level out and get that sustained power. And in the hospital and other places that rely on consistent power, they need a steady source of generation. So the temporary power is huge for that. And to your point with Tinian, they are at over 4 weeks now of not having power, and they've adapted with generation, power, with local generators, and there's been a lot of support from a lot of groups to help them out, but they're not back to a normal way of life. And even the people they're supporting, they're staying in hotels, and hotels only have limited power windows throughout the day that they even get internet or air conditioning or any other ability to charge their devices. So it's not the normal lifestyle that people are accustomed to. And that's why we are eager to get them power to the grid so that they can start enjoying the life that we've all grown to know and want. But the people there, I should say, they are so gracious and helpful and giving, and they're so thankful to have us there. But even despite this challenge that they're experiencing and the limited power that they have, they're just phenomenal communities to work with and in. So our team, that's the first thing they tell me as I circulate around, is how they're so impressed and appreciative of just the community spirit and their resilience across all the islands. So it's a really great story as we go across this engage, and my team, as they're out there, they're being brought into these communities with such warmth and appreciation. So it's really wonderful for everyone out here to see the improvement day by day, but also just to enjoy the community as they come together to be resilient and to overcome the challenges they are faced with.
Well, I think part of the reason why, you know, we're covering this story is just to be able to remind people here in Hawaii about that resiliency and how we need to work toward that. You know, I know in that area, you know, it's known as Typhoon Alley, and so they get typhoons, very strong typhoons, super typhoons on a regular basis. And they're resilient, you know, they bounce back because they know this is just what happens. All the transmission lines go down, right? The power poles, the wooden poles, the concrete poles, and you've got to rebuild back. But I also understand that there's just limitations. When we talked to the EPA folks, they said, well, there's just not enough lodging to accommodate, you know, their rapid response teams. And so they've scaled back on their footprints. And they said Army Corps has taken the lead on some of the hazardous waste removal and that kind of thing, mm-hmm. which EPA would normally be doing, let's say, here if they were hit in Hawaii.
That's correct. And lodging and workspace, that is limited for those who are helping to respond to this disaster. So we are adapting, and we're finding lodging where it's available. But speaking of living space, that's another one of our missions. A temporary roofing mission where we across the United States, at least the states that we've worked with in regularly on the hurricane side and the eastern side of the United States, we have a blue roof program that's a traditional large blue surface that is placed on top of roofs that have been damaged, and then they're tacked down to the asphalt tiles, and they're there until the homeowner is able to repair their roofs and it keeps the home dried in. Here in the Pacific, up in the territories, those just are systems that are not conducive to the construction here. It allows those blue surfaces, I describe them as a tarp, but they're more than a tarp. They're much more advanced with reinforcement and polymer design. But they will take water. There's a ponding effect. It adds weight to the roof, and it can actually compromise the structure. And also just the time it takes to get the repairs to the roofs long term here, it just needs a bit more of a enduring solution before long-term repairs can be made. So we've moved to a non-traditional roofing system here where there's a temporary roof that's made out of what's really just wooden supports and sheet metal to complement the existing roof type. That is one of our programs that we're working here, getting materials on ground, and we have crews through partnership with the Department of War and also U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has contracted local crews to come through and do this work as well with our prime contractor. And they're working through the islands to put roofs on homes so that families can move out of these shelters and get back into their homes and get some sense of normalcy back to their daily routines. So that's another great mission that we're operating with here. To date, we've installed 48 roofs, and we have a demand signal right now for about 731 across all three islands. While we're doing the temporary roofing mission, we're also moving towards debris, and we've started moving out, collecting, sorting, and reducing, and then moving out debris from Saipan. And as you mentioned, we have taken additional waste or debris streams just to help have less of a presence here in CNMI while we're trying to support the community. We don't want to overwhelm them with recovery staff. So we're working through that with great partnership with our federal partners, FEMA, and we're also working with CNMI and the local mayor's offices to phase the debris collection, to communicate how best to sort the debris so we can get it to the right locations as fast as possible.
Are you shipping off hazardous material to the continent?
We are. There. And across these three islands, it's also interesting. There are invasive species that make it sometimes difficult to ship one thing to another island or vice versa, just based on the different. I'll give you a few examples. In Saipan, there is a snail and an ant that, because of those species, it's difficult sometimes to move things from Saipan to, say, Rota or Tinian. But then Rota has a coconut rhinoceros beetle that has migrated up from Guam, that then, because of that, the biosecurity of getting things out of Rota to Saipan is takes some cleaning and some processing to get cleared. So we're working through those biosecurity concerns to make sure that we're getting things to the right places for the processing. And to answer your question, the majority of the waste streams or the debris streams will be moved off island. So the ones that will remain will be vegetative debris. To the extent possible, we'll try to chip that down and use it as mulch and other usable material for the island. There's also some construction and demolition debris that can be used here on the island and put into different areas locally. But the vast majority of the remaining debris streams will be moved off island and disposed of through either recycling or a proper disposal plant at another location.
Okay, but likely on the continent?
Yes. There was one more mission line that we are doing here that we didn't touch on yet, and that's critical infrastructure assessments. We have teams that come through, and they've gone through nearly 70 facilities across the islands, and they've rapidly looked at the structural integrity of the building, identifying any concerns that may make that location not safe to occupy, and identifying simple fixes to help remediate any issues that could allow use of that facility. One example is a youth center. It is structurally sound. Our team was there. They were able to identify that there was a water pump that had failed during the storm, and they could give appropriate guidance. And with FEMA support, they were able to get a pump quickly replaced and provide the youth center access to be used as a shelter and have a quick win with the community. So one more area that we can bring immediate support and just make sure that we keep a safe environment for the community post-storm by doing an assessment of all the facilities. But as far as cautionary tales or advice to give as we prepare for more storms, I think the standard preparations up front is important, making sure that the appropriate food and water is stocked up, people have a safe place to go to, and the family has a plan of how to respond. And then touching on an earlier point I made, the positive attitude and the strength of the community just speaks volumes post-event. Many of them have lost their homes and really all their belongings, but they have a support network here. They have a positive disposition, and the community just comes together and they support one another, and they have appreciation, and they just have a grace to them that just, it's very impressive. And for being hit so hard, the smiles and their appreciation just really is a testament to their culture and the way that they've come together as a community to weather these storms.
We've been hearing from Lieutenant Commander Adrian Biggerstaff, who heads the Super Typhoon Sinlaku recovery effort for the Army Corps of Engineers in the Western Pacific. ¶¶
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering a Master of Accounting program. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
It's Climate Solutions Week on NPR, and today we're highlighting a new climate technology that's getting local attention. Marine carbon capture takes carbon dioxide from the air and stores it in the ocean to fight global warming. The Molokai-based group Aina Momona is taking the lead locally. It's received grant funding from a group called Carbon 180. Executive Director Uaridi told HBR that he thinks it's important for Hawaii to participate in national and global conversations about climate change solutions.
Because we're facing the same problems, and even more so, like in Hawaii, everybody lives around the ocean. We know that it's rising, and you know, we'll be part of the conversation on how to, if it's possible, to take steps to mediate that, because it's affecting us and our reefs big time. So, you know, really be part of, you know, what's going on about, you know, that particular part of climate change. We kind of get left out because climate change affects us a lot.
And HBR Savannah Herman-Pote spoke with Carbon 180 team members Eric Sutton and Stacey Aguilera-Peterson.
Marine carbon dioxide removal is a term that's thrown around to mean a lot of different things, actually. There are nature-based approaches like restoring seagrasses or mangroves, as well as technology-based approaches like direct ocean capture or ocean alkalinity enhancement. So it's a wide range of different approaches to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere using the ocean's natural ability to absorb carbon.
And Stacey, if I could stay with you for a minute, is there a particular technology or strategy that Carbon 180 champions?
No, we do not endorse any approach or company or organization in this space. Rather, we are a neutral arbiter of information, and we work across NGOs, ENGOs, industry to help build the field as well as provide information to communities.
What do you think is the potential of this technology, in particular for coastal communities that are seeing some of the frontline impacts of climate change, like sea level rise, like shoreline erosion?
It's very context specific, and it should be, because communities are different. Coastal communities are very unique across the US and the world, and the ecosystem is different as well. So what might work well in one place might be very different in another place. There are some MCDR approaches that use existing, say, desalination plants or wastewater treatment plants that communities may be really excited to use that existing infrastructure already. Some communities might not want infrastructure to be built or rebuilt for MCDR purposes and might lean more heavily into more seagrass beds or something like that. So it's very context specific, and I would never want to speak for a community of what potential might be integrated in one place or another.
Okay. And you folks have partnered with community organizations in Alaska, Puerto Rico, and Hawaii. And I want to get into why you feel those partnerships are important. But first, looking at Hawaii, are there any details that you could share about the development and deployment of these technologies, when they might become something that's real that someone might encounter if they live in the islands?
I would say right now, there actually is a company that is doing research in Kona looking at direct ocean capture. And so there are researchers going out in Hawaiian waters every day right now, testing their new technology and trying to see if this would work in Hawaii or in similar places. Similarly, there's other researchers that are looking at ocean alkalinity enhancement and its impact on Hawaiian coral reefs. So I would say that nothing is at the scale of commercialization or really large scale deployment yet, but there are researchers currently today in Hawaii looking at these technologies and seeing how they might impact or benefit Hawaiian resources and communities.
And Eric, Aina Momona is Carbon 180's Hawaii-based partner, and they are creating a framework in which to have community conversations and get community feedback about this technology in a really proactive way, right? To identify community feeling before it's something that's deployed broadly on a commercial scale. Why does Carbon 180 feel that it's important to identify and then partner with organizations like Aina Momona?
I love this question. I think it's at the heart of what we do, especially on the grant making side. And so I love getting to do a lot of the grant making and lead that portfolio work. And we've been doing this work since 2022, and Making Waves as a program is really our first sort of foray into doing this on the MCDR side. And what we love to do is partner with folks as opposed to just like do a top-down grant making scenario. And so we commit to two-year grants that support general operations and carbon removal work. This includes like building internal knowledge, helping folks or supporting them in like their policy development work, but also allowing them to spend that money and spend those resources in ways and places that they feel is most important. And so it could be responding to crisis, that could be responding to pressing community initiatives. But it also means that we're supporting them and forming their own opinions. We don't advocate for them to support one particular strategy or one particular pathway. We really advocate for folks to be able to shape the projects, policies, and processes they see showing up in their communities. And so what makes Aina Momona such a good partner, they spoke a ton about like spending a lot of time being on the back foot of seeing projects come in, and they're ready to really be on the offense and really figure out like what works for them proactively. And one thing that really attracted us to Aina Momona was their understanding that folks needed to come to the table to talk to them, first and foremost, with respect for what's happening with Native Hawaiian communities in Hawaii. And then secondly, that a big growing change for them was they wanted to determine what's best for their lands, for their waters, and for the communities before decisions were ever made for them. And for us, that was a really big sort of green flag, green light, to have this sort of time just for them to like really go forward and exerting self-determination and acting these like really critical community-led restoration projects, but also really getting an opportunity for them to draft what to them is like a mountain to see understanding of the work, and for us to really get to partner in seeing that show up and become a reality. And so I think one of the biggest things they bring is a keen understanding and relationship with folks that are in their communities, and also a real understanding of how they're engaged with fishermen, cultural practitioners, youth, to really bring both education, but also a stewardship to places that they really care about.
We've seen time and again that solutions, if it's climate solutions, environmental solutions, any other solution to community, is more durable if it comes from the community. These top-down, outside approaches to how we live and how things are built only works over the long term if it's built by the people that are living with it.
This reminds me of something, actually. I report on climate and energy in particular, and so a lot of what I do all day is conversations like these where I'm speaking to people about what solutions we could potentially implement to address the concerns we have about climate change. And in one of these conversations, a researcher once said, you know, a perfect solution isn't a perfect solution if nobody wants it. Right? If you don't have the buy-in for these types of technologies or strategies, they just aren't going to work. And you folks have said that you aren't trying to guide this conversation in a particular way. You're trying to understand what the community wants. What happens if the process results in feedback from the community that says, at the end of the day, we really don't think that this is appropriate for our community and our islands?
Exactly. I know that's just as much of an answer as yes, it is. And so if not, thank you for your time. And what other climate solutions might we be able to help, you know, foster in this community? Is this something that is a long-term conversation or a no thank you and, you know, close the door? As the climate crisis increases, more and more people will see impacts in their daily life. And so I think the climate community at large will be getting asked more and more, what can we do? This is just one of many answers of what we can do, right? So communities have a whole menu of options of how they can address the climate crisis. And if MCDR is not right for them, maybe something else is.
Yeah, I think something we've learned over the past few years of doing this is yes and no mean different things to every community. And so we're really trying to get at like, what does yes mean for this particular community? What does no mean for this particular community? And also support them being able to articulate that to as many parties as they care to. I think we've seen that folks want to see more co-benefits be mentioned as folks are rolling out different work. We've seen folks want to talk about water accessibility and healthy waters as folks are coming in contact with different projects. And we've also seen folks talk about, like, what are the impacts to the land around us? What are the impacts to our ecosystems, positive or negative? They really want to see these larger, broader ecosystem changes, but also where there's benefits. And I think one thing that's really integral to success is really hearing, understanding, and implementing that feedback. And so a no from a community is as important as a yes. And what we're really trying to translate is, what does that no mean, and where does it get us? Like, what's the next thing that needs to change in order for folks to get that sort of social consent to move a project forward, or the true social no to, like, stop a project before it happens? I think we're really trying to figure out, like, what are those guardrails? What are those boundaries? What are those lines that communities want to articulate? We think that the folks that we're partnering with are doing a really fantastic job at figuring out what those boundary lines are.
That was Eric Sutton and Stacey Aguilera-Peterson with Carbon 180. It's a national nonprofit that advocates for carbon dioxide removal solutions. We will have links to learn more on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, celebrating nearly 90 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii, with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Jesmyn Ward on her new essay collection on grief, motherhood, and survival, titled On Witness and Respair. Ward won the National Book Award twice for her novels Salvage the Bones and Sing Unburied Sing. She'll tell us about finding hope after losing her brother, her partner, and her grandmother. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
Honolulu Civil Beat has a story online that some say left them with a pretty unsettling feeling. It has to do with the lack of laws regarding fertility fraud. Here with more is reporter Madeline Valera. Good morning.
Good morning.
So your story was a team effort.
Yes. Yes, I worked on this with my colleague, Caitlin Thompson.
And so share with our listeners how this got on your radar.
Yes, so we had heard these allegations. They were sort of swirling on social media that a very popular and renowned gynecologist on the North Shore, Dr. William McKenzie, had been accused of artificially inseminating some of his patients with his own sperm. And, you know, we started digging into this, and we found there had been a lawsuit about these allegations filed in 2019. So we looked further into that. You know, the lawsuit was from one of his former patients, who said that she went to him for an artificial insemination procedure in 1993. She requested a specific sperm from an anonymous Filipino donor, and she found out decades later that that is not what happened, and that she was actually inseminated by her doctor and ended up filing this lawsuit.
And so your reporting found that, so we have no laws regarding this to protect people?
Yes, that was something that a lot of people said was really disturbing. There's very little recourse for this. And, you know, this has come up across the country. I spoke to an expert who said she's aware of more than 50 cases of this kind of conduct, you know, in various states around the country. And so many times, you know, victims just don't know how to hold these doctors accountable. There aren't specific laws, you know, that outlaw this. And sometimes they even have trouble getting justice through, you know, civil procedures. So many states, at least 14 states, have passed laws that specifically outlaw this type of conduct or make it easier for victims to sue.
And your story, though, has gotten some traction, right? I mean, it's now on people's radars, at least some lawmakers anyway.
Yes, lawmakers here are now starting to talk about the fact that we need more protections here in our state. Representative Amy Peruso, who's on the North Shore, she posted a video on Instagram shortly after the story came out saying, you know, that she was so shocked that many members of the community, you know and love this doctor. He's been practicing there for more than 50 years. You know, in that part of the island, he's just had seen almost everyone. He was just so popular. And, you know, she was really shocked and appalled by it. And she, you know, posted on her social media that she's hoping to work on legislation for next session. So I plan to follow up with her and learn the details of what she wants to get passed.
Yeah, because there's that trust factor, right? If this is a doctor in your community.
Absolutely. It's just such a violation. And, you know, the experts I spoke to say it impacts not only the patient, but the children who find out about this years later. You know, often they find out about it through these consumer genetic testing websites like 23andMe or Ancestry.com. They start matching with half-siblings that they never knew existed. And that can be just really, you know, traumatic and disturbing for people. So yeah. It has really wide-reaching implications.
Yeah, because in small communities, you could be dating your cousin or your brother. You just never know.
Right, and that has happened. There was a case of that in Connecticut where a woman, you know, reported that someone that she dated in high school turned out to have been her half-brother, you know, so you just never know. And an expert I spoke to, too, said that people aren't aware of their own medical histories because, you know, they don't know their own genetic makeup. So that can also be really damaging.
And then what do the regulators say?
Yes, that's another part of this. You know, in this case, Dr. McKenzie, he was never disciplined for this by the licensing board. He was disciplined, but it was for failing to disclose this lawsuit when he renewed his medical license. But even though he's retired, he actually continues to hold an active license in good standing. So, you know, some states that have started to look into this are also saying that doctors should be stripped of their license if they're found to have done this conduct. So that's something that the state will have to look at as well.
Yeah, it certainly raises so many questions, and hopefully we can tighten up the laws, you know, in order to protect our community.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be really interesting to see how lawmakers plan to address this and what they do next session.
Well, thanks so much for this story. Good job.
Yes, thank you so much.
We've been hearing from Civil Beat reporter Madeline Rolera. Look for the story at civilbeat.org. With the merger of Alaska and Hawaiian Airlines, the company controls nearly half of the traffic between Hawaii and the U.S. continent. There is a new Alaska Hawaiian app as the two brands recently merged passenger reservation systems. And those changes have put us in a reflective mood. We are delighted today to share an interview with the oldest living former pilot of Hawaiian Airlines. Gilbert Hicks is 98 years old. He came to Hawaii in 1949 with the U.S. Navy. He spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about landing in Kahi Lagoon in a Martin Mars flying boat. Hicks was picked up and taken to Barbers Point, and he says the ride was one he'll never forget.
You can imagine in those days, it was just a little old two-lane road from the Pearl Harbor area all the way out to Barbers Point. And, as you know, sugar was king in those days. And so we're driving. It was still so early in the morning. It was still kind of dark, probably early trade wind showers. And the cane was so tall, it practically covered over the whole road. So you think you're driving down a dark tunnel almost through Eva till you got all the way out. So on the way, I was beginning to wonder, what have I gotten myself into? But it all worked out very well. So that's how I arrived on July 15th, 1949.
1949. You had already earned your wings at that point.
Yes, I had. So I was assigned to a squadron at Barbers Point, VP-22. We flew the Navy's version of a B-24. It was called a PB-4Y2. It was designed as a submarine hunter, is what its mission was. So anyway, I arrived at Barbara's Point and the sun came out and it was a nice day. My Navy career was pretty short. I was out of the Navy and at Hawaiian Airlines by the following June 1st.
Why'd you join Hawaiian Airlines?
Oh, well, there's a group of us that we all wanted to stay in Hawaii if we could. And we heard that Hawaiian was hiring, which was a usual practice. As the summer approached, the traffic would pick up, and they would hire a few pilots and flight attendants for the summer. And they told you, okay, you're on for the summer, but comes Labor Day, you're furloughed, which was the case. Hiring was a little different. Well, it was different for us. We went in for an interview with Captain Sam Elliott, and he talked to us a little bit. There were two of us, Bill Warren, had been a close buddy since 1945, and I said, oh, well, are you boys from Barbara's Point? Yes, sir. Oh, okay, you're hired. And by the way, I'll see you down at Fort DeRussy next Tuesday for the Naval Reserve meeting. And here's your application for a correspondence course so you can earn your points. So I'll see you there. Yes, sir, Captain. And we were there. And fortunately, that was good for me because we continued in the Naval Reserve. And that has been a big benefit all over the years. So with that, come June 1st, started at Hawaiian. And at Hawaiian, that's where I wanted to show Mike Machado. His grandfather was teaching us the intricacies of a DC-3 and finally got us trained up to where we were turned loose as co-pilots at Hawaiian.
So initially you were flying inter-island on the DC-3. What some of those routes? Waimea, Hana, Molokai, Lanai?
Oh, yeah, we flew all the airports and the island. Let's see, Kauai and obviously Oahu and Molokai and Lanai and then over to Maui and then into Hana and then down to Hilo and we flew to Kona, of course.
Commuter flights mainly, tourists? Who are on those planes?
Local business people and yes, of course, tourists, especially during the summertime. We had quite a few tourists. Tourists liked it. In fact, later on, they were always modifying those airplanes a little bit. But we had them, they call it the Viewmaster. It had a long window on each side. And we were giving day tours with that as best we could. Fly around the islands and you could dip the wing and the people on could go either side. And the people could get a pretty good look at the islands. And then they would always land on those tours and then they would the lunch would probably be a big attraction. And we made, over the years, made a couple of unusual trips. Well, one was one of the plantations thought they would try grazing pineapple on the Big Island. And in fact, this was in 1950, the first year there. So you take the top of a pineapple and put that in the ground and you grow another pineapple. Well, so we spent 3 days ferrying pineapple tops from Maui over to Apollo Point. So I never saw so many pineapples. I didn't know there were that many pineapple tops. They had just huge piles of them on Maui and load those onto the plane and we'd take them over to Apollo. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look, pineapple growing on a Big Island never took off. So there's no pineapples growing on the Big Island. But flying in and out of Apollo Point was kind of interesting.
Yeah,
it's not the longest runway in the world by any means, but it may be the windiest, one of the windiest.
So at one point, as you're flying for Hawaiian, you meet a college girl who is spending the summer as a flight attendant. Yeah. Tell us about Patsy.
Yes, to my good fortune, I met Patsy Conahilly. That was in 1950, I guess. Ruby Pua, who had been a house mother at Kamehameha, was now the chief flight attendant at Hawaiian. And so she hired a lot of Kamehameha girls. Patsy was class of 46 graduate of Kamehameha. And now she's, of course, in college. And so after the summer, she went back to and graduated from Berkeley. And we were married in 52. And I thought it was quite an accomplishment for what they taught kids at Kamehameha in those days to go on to Berkeley. She was a smart lady. And let's see, it was, well, I guess that's about it. The odd trips of the DC-3, well, of course, everybody remembers the one where the baby was born on the airplane. We took off from Maui, and the flight attendant came up and said, "Hey, this woman back here says she's having a baby." So you can imagine two guys up in a cockpit. "Ho, ho, ho, she thinks she's having a baby." Well, I went back to look. Well, my wife had given birth to our son, Art, just a few months earlier, almost in the car. I knew what a woman about to have a baby looked like. So I rushed back to the cockpit and I said, "Yes, she's having a baby." And we obviously turned around back to Maui, called for an ambulance, and landed. The baby was born in the air. The lady just laid down. And we're all very fortunate that that baby was healthy, you know, because she was a premature child. And they said the ambulance crew, I think the same as our first reaction, they weren't ringing a siren or anything. They were stopping for the stoplights and taking away coming to the airport. But I got a hand it to them. When they got there, they swung into action and took care of the situation. We had later on a first birthday party for her. And then many years later, of course, on her 16th birthday, we took her to Hilo, gave her a ride to Hilo.
What a great story. We've been hearing from Gil Hicks, the oldest living pilot for Hawaiian Airlines. Hicks and his wife, the late Patsy Kanaheli, were married for more than 64 years. We'll have more from this interview right after a break. And a note, Hawaiian Airlines is an HPR underwriter.
Support for HPR comes from Aloha Air Cargo, connecting Hawaii by providing inter-island shipping with services including Aloha Next Flight Out, Aloha Standard Overnight, and Aloha Economy. AlohaAirCargo.com.
Here's the right-wing criticism of America's most elite colleges. Too elite, too woke, they coddle their students, they don't encourage political diversity, they can't be trusted. Well, a Yale University commission recently published a year-long self-examination and concluded the critics may be right. And the commission has a list of solutions to help rebuild trust in higher education. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Gas, offering tips to help local residents and businesses prepare for natural disasters and emergencies. Learn more at hawaiigas.com/safety.
Welcome back. Today we have the rare treat of hearing from retired Hawaiian Airlines pilot Gil Hicks, who flew for the airline for nearly 40 years. In that time, he made trips to Christmas Island, Wake and Midway Atoll, Brussels, Helsinki, and Alaska. But one journey that stands out in his mind was to what was then the trust territory of the Pacific Islands, now the Federated States of Micronesia, the Republic of the Marshall Islands, Palau, and the Northern Marianas. Hicks tells a story to HPR's Maddie Bender.
The trust territory came up for grabs or for a new route. Pan Am had it. And trust territory over the century had changed hands several times between Germany and Japan and finally the U.S. And so Pan Am was flying it. So we, the company, put together a team to go out and make application for the trust territory route. We took the DC-6 and flew to Wake, to Guam, And from Guam, we went up to Tinian. The island everyone remembers best was Yap Island. Then we went on to the other Trust Terry Islands, Truk and Babbledop. And then we came on Quaj Majuro and then back down into Honolulu. We were gone, I don't know, 3-4 weeks. But when you go on something like that, you're usually wined and dined everywhere you went. So it was a wonderful trip. Never forget that.
Yeah.
And it's an aside, but my son became a pilot and was with Continental to start with. Oh, by the way, the route went to Continental, mm-hmm. not to Hawaiian.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I should say that. So he was at Continental, and shortly thereafter, he was stationed on Guam and flew the Trust Territory route for Continental. They really liked flying out there because you had the sky to yourself. It wasn't like trying to get into busy New York or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they used to fly Guam up to Japan and back and then on from the, they had a circuit to the Trust Terry, wind up in Honolulu, have a couple of days rest and then take the circuit back to Guam. And he did that for a few years.
That must have been a proud moment watching your son fly the route as when you had tried to chart it for Hawaiian.
Yeah, right.
You must have seen all these airlines rise and fall over your time. I mean, there are some that don't exist anymore. There are some so different from how they used to be.
Well, that's true. Oh, like Pan Am.
Yeah.
We used to come in to Pan Am Flight 1 and Flight 2. They used to cross at Honolulu at noon practically every day. And we could, when we were coming in on a flight to land around noontime, you generally hear Pan Am calling in. So many airlines have come and gone. I thought Hawaiian was going to be a holdout, but I see now we've finally merged into Alaska. But, you know, you had like airlines like TWA, you had Eastern, and Pan American, of course. Well, now one last vestige of, you all know the building, in fact, it's close by here. Pan Am building.
That's where I parked my car this morning.
Yeah. Well, that, when that building was built, back then I knew the architect, Don Chapman, Pan American had their office down there on the ground floor for a while. And then, of course, they started phasing out when the financial troubles turned in. By the way, you know that Hawaiian and Pan American started in the same year, 1929. Going into the Depression.
Wow.
What a year to start an airline. But anyway, they survived for quite a while.
Do you see with the merger as recently as in April, the HA airline code being retired, switching now to AS for Alaska? Is that the end of Hawaiian or what do you think?
I hope not completely. We still think the Pualani tail, Alaska should have been wise to, well, I don't know. That's selfish, I guess. It appears that they're going to keep Pualani inner island, but it'll stay. But all the overseas routes will be strictly Alaskan and Alaskan tail emblem. And they've taken our the 787s that we had. They're going to reconfigure those and use them in fact. I have a grandson that's with Hawaiian, and he's flying a 787 as a co-pilot. Most of his flights are Seattle to Korea at the present time, anyway. But I just hope the merger works out, because sometimes mergers don't do too well, but I think this one should survive all right. Yeah, I guess for the nostalgia, we'd hate to see the Pualani tail disappear entirely. I think it's one of the prettiest ones out there. And if you look down at, say, Los Angeles someplace, you see a whole bunch of airplanes lined up. Boy, that one always stands out.
Your whole family, then, are airplane pilots. Your son, your grandson.
Yes, I guess so. I said, too many pilots. I need some doctors and lawyers. But my son is a pilot. Well, he's retired from Continental. I've merged into United. He's retired now. My daughter was a pilot for Island Air. People that know seniority, she was the number two pilot on their list. And her husband, my son-in-law, John, was a pilot with Hawaiian Airlines. now retired, of course. Yeah, we had plenty of pilots, and of course my wife had started as a flight attendant, and so aviation household, I guess.
Your granddaughter's here today. I was talking with your son. Like, clearly you have a big family that loves you very much. You've put down roots here. Any advice for people, for listeners?
Oh, well, I don't know. Just be thankful for what you've got, I guess. And I'm very lucky to have so many grandchildren. And my wife and I just had two children, and out of that came 14 grandchildren. And now I see the great-grandchildren. Let's see, we got another one the other day. I got four, five, six, seven. Oh, I guess that would make eight. There must be about eight great-grandchildren now. So, well, one thing it is said, and you see it in the newspaper every day, that the price of paradise has just gotten out of reach for people. You've got to have a very well-paying job to really live comfortably in Hawaii today. And that's very sad, but I guess that's the way of economies these days. If it's a beautiful spot, it gets priced out of reach for the people that made it beautiful, which is too bad.
It's just, what a change, thinking about that first car ride through the sugarcane as high as your eye can see to now, I mean, running out of space to build housing.
Yeah, that's right. It's all gone now.
Anything else about your career as a pilot living in Hawaii for so many years? You're 98?
Yeah, 98 now. So, no, it was a wonderful career. Hawaii was a great place to bring up kids. I guess I hit it at kind of the golden age. Anyway, it was really lucky. Nice career. Hawaiian was a great airline to work for. We had great airplanes. We flew and we got into the jets. The DC-9 was a great airplane. Really a wonderful career. Couldn't ask for anything better. I guess when I grew up as a kid, I just had my eyes in the sky. All I could think of was being a pilot. And I was fortunate enough that I became one and enjoyed every minute of it.
Thank you so much, Gil Hicks, for your time today.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
That was retired Hawaiian Airlines pilot Gil Hicks reflecting on a 37-year career for the airline and a life well lived. That's a wrap for today. Tomorrow, with rising sea levels, we take a trip to Coconut Island. What's the future of its marine science research? We welcome feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us or hit us up on social media. Find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple, or check our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.